Hello and welcome to Listen Closely with John and Chris. I'm John out here in beautiful southern New England, and I am joined by Chris. Christopher, how are you?
John, I'm well. Thank you.
How are you? I'm delightful, as Rex Harrison would say. So it's, wow, it is October. And, you know, the leaves are falling and all that sad stuff. And it blew my mind to think that October marks 6 months of Listen Closely with John and Chris. Now, I know that 6 months doesn't sound like much, but for something that was an afterthought idea born out of being... laid up in bed with COVID in late March.
Yes.
I'm quite proud of what we've done here in 6 months.
Can I just make clear that you were laid up in bed with COVID? We weren't laid up in bed with COVID together.
Nothing wrong
with that, but, you know.
No. I agree. Thank you for clarifying that. No, that means okay. A lot. I never thought it would last this long, to be honest with you. 6 months, 23 episodes. I think, is this episode number 23? I believe it is. I never thought we would have made it. And again, I know to some this doesn't sound like a major accomplishment, but I'm going to take some time and pat myself on the back, and I should hope you're going to do the same, Chris. And I want to thank you, Chris, my partner in crime, though not in that way, as you indicated. But rather the yin to my yang, or vice versa, the Vanzetti to my Sacco, the Ehrlichman to my Haldeman. It is you, Christopher.
Wow. This is sort of like the Jerry Maguire "You Complete Me" speech here. I'm a little choked.
Show me the money, baby.
No, it's been a lot of fun. Yeah, it just sort of started as a lark, and it's been great. And I think we got to thank all the listeners, too. We've been getting listeners across just about every continent, actually, which is kind of crazy. Hopefully here's to at least another 6 months more.
I should hope so. I mean, it's been quite a ride. And again, I thank you. I wouldn't go as far as to say I couldn't do it without you. I mean, I could do it without you.
You did the first episode without me. So,
right. Yeah. But it wouldn't be nearly as good without you. And frankly, it wouldn't be nearly as good without our listeners, which you just mentioned. And this is important to note. In 6 short months, we have grown our listening audience significantly through some minor marketing efforts, but also just from, I don't know, osmosis, who knows. But I'm proud to say that close to 30% of the Listen Closely audience are located overseas. We have listeners in countries that I didn't even think listened to podcasts, to be quite honest with you. Even more fascinating is that we have listeners in some real far-flung lands. We have listeners in Saudi Arabia. Did you know this?
No. Get out of here.
We do. Are you ready for this? We have listeners in Lithuania. And I bring this up because, you know, little known fact to our listeners, although your dad's family is from the same part of southern Italy as my father, your mother's family, if I'm not mistaken, is Lithuanian.
They are. Yeah, 100%. Wow, that's amazing.
So to our Lithuanian listeners, if you are listening to this episode, our boy Chris here is kind of one of your people. Chris, can you say anything in Lithuanian to them?
Oof, I don't think I can.
All right, never mind.
I'll have to work on that.
Fine. I can't say anything in Saudi Arabian, so it's perfectly fine.
I don't think that's a language, but you know, whatever.
Whatever. but I thank the fans. What's that?
I think, yeah, to our Lithuanian listeners, hit us up on Twitter, to any of our listeners, I would love to hear from you from the homeland at Podcast Closely.
Or hit us up on Instagram at listencloselypodcast. And really, thank you to the listeners for your continued support and your patience. And I should hope that moving forward, you keep listening to us. You know, cities are burning. The pandemic is still sweeping the country. And we're in the midst of a nutty little thing called the presidential election. Now more than ever, you need Listen Closely with John and Chris in your life.
Undoubtedly. It's the medicine you need to get you through this.
It really is. And on that note, Chris, would you like to intro this week's fantastic album?
I would. This is our first repeat performer on this closely. Break out the red headbands again. We're going to October of 1980 for Dire Straits' classic Making Movies.
That's right. Released October 17th, 1980. We're celebrating the 40th birthday of this amazing album. And it should be said, this is a few years before Knopfler really started rocking the red headband and became an MTV superstar. And in October of 1980, he released what I feel truly is his masterpiece, Making Movies. I don't know about you, Chris, but if I were to summarize this album in a single word, it would be beautiful. I just think that musically and lyrically, this album is absolutely beautiful. Sometimes even moving.
Oh, definitely moving. Yeah, I think, you know, amazingly, this album's only about 37, 38 minutes long. It's only got 7 tracks, you know, but it manages to cram so much in there. And I think it's a really important album for Dire Straits too. You know, they kind of evolved. This was their third album. The first one was really warmly received. Second one, not so much. And here they really bounced back with a fantastic album.
They really did. And you know, you talk about it being only 37 minutes in length. There's only 7 tracks. And as I was listening to it a lot, gladly over the last week or so, I thought back to our younger days, not that we're old, but when you and I were probably in elementary or middle school, and we had this fascination with baseball, and in particular with the statistical side of baseball. I think back to that computer baseball game we used to play on my brother's old Commodore 64. And we actually used to keep box scores on the players. Do you remember this? And we were so hung up on just the statistics of these players.
Oh, yeah.
The point I'm getting at is Making Movies has only 7 songs, but in my opinion, 5 of them are some of my all-time favorites. And statistically speaking, that makes this album pretty damn amazing.
Yeah, there's not much not to like on it. You know, it's got, you know, I would say 3 or maybe more, maybe 5. I don't know if I'd go 5. I think to me there's like maybe 3 just incredible songs, a couple really good songs, and then a couple, you know, not bad. But yeah, it's tremendous. I think they, you know, I think one of the big things here is the bringing in of Roy Batan.
Absolutely, from the E Street Band.
Yeah. I mean, I think that adds such a layer of complexity to this album that Dire Straits didn't have before, as good as they were before. It just added another element that turned it up to 11, so to speak.
It did. It really did. I mean, for me, this album is possibly in my top 10 of all time, if not top 10, top 15, if such a thing were to exist. I think it's just that damn good. I really do.
That's amazing. I mean, I like this album a lot, but that's some high praise right there.
Well, you'll understand why as we dig deeper into it. But I think there's just a lot here, and I really just think the songs are incredible, and it really shows off the genius of Mark Knopfler. The Brothers in Arms album was the commercially successful one. It was the one that really made them global superstars, MTV darlings. But I think this is a much, much better album, in my opinion. You know, it's interesting because listening to it, over the years, I've always wondered what the catalyst was to name the album Making Movies. I know that it's a line from one of the songs in the album, Skate Away, which was originally titled Making Movies, from what I read. But I always thought that, you know, based on the album and the content of the album, I always thought like Tunnel of Love or Romeo and Juliet would have made the better album title. But, you know, listening to it, Chris, several times this last week or so, it finally dawned on me, I think. And I see this album like a film, much like you did a couple weeks ago with Brian Ferry's Bette Noir. But this to me is a film with Knopfler as the brilliant auteur. And in my opinion, or my belief, my view of the album, it's a film that's made up of seven different vignettes with the occasional overlapping theme or recurring motif within the vignettes, like young love and lust, something like that. And I think that's what really makes this album interesting. I think it makes this album at times complex. Knopfler, as we noted during the Brothers in Arms episode last season, started out as a newspaper reporter, and he has a great ability to tell these very well detailed, clever stories. And I think that's really evident here on this album. But he isn't simply telling fictional tales. There's a deeply personal moment on this album for him that I think casual listeners don't pick up on. And it's, do you know what moment I'm referring to before I?
No.
It's inarguably what's the album's most famous track, number two, Romeo and Juliet. And did you know that that song is partially based on Knopfler's failed relationship with Holly Vincent, who was lead singer of a late 70s band called Holly and the Italians? Strange band. Did you not know that?
I did not, no, no.
I didn't either. It was one of my former bosses, actually, a fellow who I worked for a few years ago. He's a diehard music fan, big Dire Straits fan, actually told me this. And as we were prepping for this episode, I looked into it. Knopfler felt, because Knopfler was somewhat of a success at the time that he was writing this album, he felt that Holly Vincent was using him to further her career. If she was, it didn't work, because I really have no clue who the hell Holly Vincent is. I don't think most of our listeners do.
Right.
But in an interview that's a different story. In an interview shortly after their breakup, when asked about Knopfler, Vincent replied, "What happened was that I had a scene with Mark Knopfler, and it got to the point where he couldn't handle it, and we split up." Hence the line, "Now you just say Romeo. Oh, yeah, you know, I used to have a scene with him."
Oh, wow.
So, again, I go back to the motif of young love, of breakdowns of relationship. And I think there are, again, Knopfler is telling stories here, as he does a great job. But there is that moment in Romeo and Juliet, which is perhaps one of a few moments on the album, I don't know, that's, I think, deeply personal for Mark Knopfler. And I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, and I think this album really just shows off so much of what Knopfler is about. And what I mean by that is that he's so brilliant, but he's so subtle, I think, in just about every way. Whether it's the stories that he tells, or as you referenced when we did Brothers in Arms, his guitar playing is, right. I mean, he's a virtuoso, but he never comes out and just hits you over the head with some screaming solo. You know, he kind of eases into it, and you almost don't even realize it. And then you're swept up in this gorgeous solo. You know, his guitar playing is a little more subdued on this than maybe other albums, but you know, there's definitely several songs here where he busts out a great solo, but it's just so smooth and seamless within the songs. You know, I liken it to, you know, I think a lot of guys when they do, or girls when they do a guitar solo, you know, it's kind of like an actor who wants to do the Pacino thing, you know, and they're just coming at it, you know, like Pacino, you know, just over the top. But Nofer is like a really good actor who just kind of, he never forces it. He just kind of lets the moment develop. And I think that's his genius.
I agree. He's graceful, elegant, and understated, I think, yeah, when it comes to his guitar work. And to me, I think he's one of the greatest. And I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what the critics had to say about this, shall we?
Sure.
In their February 1981 review of the album, I think Rolling Stone magazine said it best. They said, quote, "If making movies really were a film, it might win a flock of Academy Awards," end quote. And in 1989, they would rank Making Movies number 52 in their survey of the 100 best albums of the 1980s. In a modern review for AllMusic.com, Stephen Thomas Erlewine claims that Making Movies ranks among the band's finest work. And I would have to agree with that.
Absolutely.
So what do you think? Should we dive into our picks, Chris?
Yeah, let's do it. I think this is going to be a very interesting set of picks here.
I'm ready. Bring it on.
All righty.
So with that in mind, Chris, what did you go with as your nadir?
Very tough one. For me, this came down to two songs, and they just so happen to be the last two songs on the album.
Mm-hmm.
While I don't particularly love Les Boys, I'm going to give them some credit for doing that song in 1980. It's a bizarre topic to tackle. So I went with Solid Rock.
Really?
Which, you know, this is an amazing album, and Dire Straits fans, don't, you know, castigate me here. I'm not saying it's a bad song. I actually think there's a lot of moments in this song that are great. There's kind of a fantastic driving beat to it. But for me, there's something about the refrain that just, it rubs me the wrong way. I think it's the repetition of Solid Rock, Solid Rock, Solid Rock.
Can you do that one more time?
No, I will not.
Come on, man. Repeat it. That was
rock,
awesome.
Solid rock. It grates on me a little bit. And again, this is like, you know, picking out flaws in a diamond here. It's, there's not a lot in this album, but if I had to, I'd go with that one.
Really?
Your thoughts?
I don't love Solid Rock. I think it's coming on the heels of the five songs that come before it.
Well,
it's, yeah, it's nothing. But Les Boys is really terrible. It's a terrible song. But I'm gonna stand up for Les Boys a little later on in this episode. But it. This segues into my nadir, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I don't think Solid Rock is great. It's a little repetitive with that Solid Rock. So, do you want to do it again?
Solid Rock, Solid Rock, Solid Rock. I'm sorry, Mark Knopfler. I know that there's a good chance that you're listening to this. I love you, man.
I think Solid Rock's an okay song. But I feel like Knopfler saved the worst for last, and my nadir is obviously Les Boys.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so strange.
It is.
And, you know, Chris, some of the more modern reviews that I read about this album, you know, they sing the praises of the album, but they've gone as far as to call this song offensive.
Yeah.
Because, well, I mean, there's homosexual references, but then there's kind of a Nazi component to it as well, right?
Oh, there is. It's the Les Boys wear, what is it, wear Nazi hats or caps or something.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, though, what I will say for it is, again, some bold subject matter. I mean, this is a song about Les Boys are sort of effeminate young homosexuals who would have sex on the down low before it was known as the down low with like rich businessmen. I think that's at least what my understanding of it is.
Long before Grindr.
Yeah. You know, musically, I don't, the song does nothing for me. You know, I think it says something about Knopfler, though, that he was willing to write a song like this in 1980 to explore that element of society. You know, I did read something, somebody asked him about it in an interview, and he said, you know, that he kind of, whatever he's writing, he tries to find parallels, and you know, and that one might not seem like there's a lot of parallels to Dire Straits, but he said, you know, these boys are sort of like performers in a way, and you go into these bars, and you know, he said he could relate to them as like a performer in a sense. And I don't know. I mean, I'm with you. It's not a good song.
But you still think it's better than Solid Rock?
I don't, in terms of like, I would never listen to this song. I'm just giving him credit for the artistic, for taking on something outside of the box.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's move on, shall we? Yeah.
I mean, at least this went better than the last Nadir when we did Dire Straits, when our friendship almost ended over Walk of Life.
Walk, you know what? Don't even go there. Walk of Life is a terrible song.
All right, let's listen to the Walk of Life episode, folks, and you can be the judge. But
dog-faced pony soldier. All right, Christopher, let's get on the right track here, hopefully. Lay it on me. Your sleeper moment of Dire Straits making movies.
So sleeper moment, to me, there were a couple possibilities here. And in the end, I went with the fourth track, Espresso Love.
Ooh, great song.
Yeah, it's great. I think, you know, it's one that as I dove into this over the last week or two, you know, I wasn't as familiar with that as I was with, of course, Romeo and Juliet, Tunnel of Love, Skate Away, but I don't know, it really grabbed me this time around. I think it's definitely a little grittier, a little harder edge to it than what comes before. So it's kind of cool in that way. It mixes it up a little bit. You know, it's a little ridiculous in a way, kind of, all these coffee references and
no, I don't want no sugar in it.
Right. But it's fun. And you know,
it is.
I just really think it's a good track. Keeps the album going, keeps it moving.
It's a great song.
Yeah. How about you?
It was tough. You know, part of me was going to go with Espresso Love, but I think that the first three or four tracks on this album, including Espresso Love, received some degree of airplay and still do on like classic rock radio. And there was even a quite interesting music video for Skate Away that I remember seeing as a child on MTV back in the day. But I ultimately went with Hand in Hand, which I feel is the very definition of a sleeper moment. You know, it's this sweet little gem of a song buried on the second side of the album. It doesn't have the guitar virtuosity on display that the rest of the album does, but it has this beautiful melody And thematically, it's similar to some of the other songs in the album. I love it. I always have. I think it's just a great song. And lyrically, it's amazing. I love the refrain. If I've been hard on you, I never chose to be. I never wanted no one else. And I tried my best to be somebody you'd be close to, hand in hand like lovers are supposed to. And, you know, in some way, I see this kind of the sequel to Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful. Beautiful song. And you're right. It is. It's kind of the definition of a sleeper. And in some ways, this album reminds me a lot, not in terms of the style, but in sort of the overall makeup of it, of Asia by Steely Dan, which we did a couple months ago. Just in that it's seven songs, but it packs so much in. And that one also, if you remember, you get, you know, you start out with like four huge heavy hitters.
Right.
Then you get Home at Last, which is, it, you know, kind of takes it down a notch. It lets you catch your breath in the same way that Hand in Hand does, I think, for making movies.
I would agree. Very similar in that respect. So that takes us to the zenith. And what do you have?
This was a tough one. I feel like I always say that, but it's true. You know, I think Romeo and Juliet is probably the best track, sort of as objectively as can be stated on this album. I'm a little worn down by it. I've heard it so many times. It makes me think of our high school dances.
That's right. It was the theme to one of the proms, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it was, yeah. Skate Away is actually probably my favorite song on this album.
Right.
But I went with a more of a moment here. The last 2 minutes of Tunnel of Love, to
what
me,
the fuck?
Are, why'd you say, what the fuck?
Finish, please.
All right, the last 2 minutes of that, it's Knopfler. Guitar. He eases into this guitar solo. You almost don't even realize it's a solo until you're halfway into it, because it's so smooth. Like we talked about before, you know, he doesn't hit you over the head. He just kind of starts off on this little jaunt, and the next thing you know, you are swept up in this gorgeous melody. And then, and this is the big thing, Roy Batan comes in in parts of that solo, especially towards the end, and it's this beautiful addition on the keyboards that he adds. And the two of them, between Knopfler on the guitar, Batan on the keyboard, it just says to me, it's kind of this announcement of like, we're back and we are just better than ever. We have taken things up to the next level. Get ready for the album that's going to blow your fucking doors off. And I just love that moment.
It's first class rock and roll.
Yeah.
I said what the fuck earlier.
Yeah.
Because that is exactly what I chose as my zenith.
What?
Yeah, I'll show you my notes. I will take a picture of the notes that I'm reading and text it to you right now. But my notes here say, very difficult decision to make. But much like I did on the first episode of the season, I went with a moment on this album. And that moment is the last 2.5 minutes of the lead-off track, Tunnel of Love.
Oh, my God.
And you said it best. I mean, I'll add a couple things here. It starts for me, Chris, when Knopfler repeats the song's refrain toward the end, but in a hushed, almost whisper of a tone. Mm. He's almost speaking it. He says, girl, you look so pretty to me, like it always did, like the Spanish city to me when we were kids. And after that, what comes next is what I consider to be some of the most beautiful outro music ever. Yeah. And it's just like you said, it's Knopfler, it's Batan. Knopfler has what I think is one of his greatest guitar solos. And, you know, it's his brother who's playing acoustic guitar at that moment as well.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
And what I especially love is, if you notice, the guitar solo builds to this climax, this crescendo, but right as it climaxes, he steps back. And that's when Batan takes center stage.
Right.
And then Knopfler jumps back in the final seconds. And just like you said, it's him and Batan performing together in unison at that moment. And it, oh man, it's magical. It is real. It's one of those moments, just like my Zenith from Hotel California a few weeks ago, which was Pretty Maids All in a Row, the last vocal harmony at the end. It's one of those musical moments that I can repeat, I can put on repeat and listen to over and over and over again. It is just absolutely beautiful.
It's so gorgeous. That's a testament to how good it is that the two of us would pick the same 2.5 minute clip out of a full album as the high point of the album. I mean, that's...
Exactly. Yeah. And I would argue that Tunnel of Love is probably the best song on the album. Maybe I'm wrong.
Could be.
But, you know, like you, I also really have a soft spot for Skate Away. And Romeo and Juliet's beautiful. But that last 2.5 minutes where he sort of brings it home at the end with Roy Batan. And it's just, words really can't describe it. And this is one of those moments where I wish our fans would really donate shit tons of money to us so we can license get the rights to play songs, because this is one of those moments where I just want to go to the clip and say, enough of us talking, listen to what we're trying to say, because words can't convey how beautiful this moment is.
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal. I just think of being a Dire Straits fan in 1980. You know, you love the first album. Maybe you liked the second one, not quite as good. People were talking a little trash about it in terms of reviews. And you're saying, what are they going to come up with for the third album? And they come out and with this fantastic first track, and then it closes with that. And you're just thinking, oh my God, oh my God.
And the intro to the track, let's not forget, is sampled from the musical Carousel by Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty wild. Pretty wild way to start out an album.
It is, but you're absolutely right. It's like you're a fan. You weren't impressed with the last album. You put it on. You're thinking, all right, let's give this a try. And you listen to the first 3-4 minutes of Tunnel of Love, and you're like, this is a really good song. It's catchy. And then that last 2.5 minutes, Knopfler and Roy Batan, holy shit. It is sheer perfection.
Yeah. I think the Batan factor on this album is not to be underestimated. In Skate Away too, there's just some fantastic keyboard parts in that I think give that, it adds like, you know, this girl's sort of skating through the city and in her own world with her headphones on, and somehow in Skate Away it's more of like a piano sound, like a street piano sound than a synth keyboard, and it just adds some sort of grandeur to it.
It does.
Yeah, it's just so good, so good.
How well do you think this album captures the cultural zeitgeist of 1980 or the early 1980s?
I think it does a pretty good job of it. I think songs like Skate Away, a song like Tunnel of Love, I think those, you know, much in the same way, it's very, very E Street Bandish, kind of getting into that part of life of like young love, kind of coming into the world. So I think so. I mean, you know, it even throws in Les Boys as another part
true.
Of the 80s. So yeah, I think, you know, maybe not like when we talked about Brothers in Arms, I mean, that one just reeks of like mid 80s. It's like the quintessential sound. This one, maybe not quite as much, but I think so. How about you?
I don't know. I don't think it does. And I don't think it really tried to. But I think the music and the stories here have a timeless quality of them, just like Romeo and Juliet do.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't really pick up on much of an 80s vibe here. I could be wrong. But no, I don't think it does, but I don't think it has to, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm because this comes out in 80, so I definitely don't get like a a mid-80s vibe from it. But, you know, kind of that early 80s, I guess with the keyboard too, you know, a lot of the time sounding more like a piano. I mean, there were a lot of late 70s, early 80s stuff that's like that, whether it's the E Street Band, Springsteen, or, you know, not to compare this sound to Billy Joel, but like, you know, he had a lot of piano. I think there's elements of it that are, that were pretty, pretty timely for that era. But I also agree with you that these songs are really timeless. I mean, this is the 40th anniversary, and these songs, I think, hold up incredibly.
They do. Do you have any particular memories associated with the album or any pop culture references that jump out at you as you listen to it?
I was going to say the Romeo and Juliet, our high school dances, that are right. Factoring in, like we discussed, you know, we kind of already covered that. You know, this was an album that I didn't really get into until the last 10 years or so. So, you know, I don't really remember much of these from when I was a kid, but I can remember hearing songs like Skate Away for the first time and just being floored by it. What about yourself? Do you have any particular memories?
I do, yeah. There was, this is going back several years ago, probably close to 20, I was seeing this young lady, and we'd been out maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 times at this point. And it was right around this time of year, I think, probably in October. And it was later in the evening after we had had a few drinks at the bar, and we got in my car to take a ride. And as you know, Chris, when you live in this town and you unfortunately live with your parents, as I did at that time, there's only one place in a situation like this that you could take a young lady to, and that is the beach. So we're driving in my car to the beach, and I Making Movies happened to be the CD that was in my CD player in my car at that moment. And what made this all the more interesting is that the song that was playing at the time that we were driving down on the beach was Hand in Hand. And this young lady started singing along, telling me how much she loved the song and how it was one of her favorites. So not only was I impressed by the fact that, you know, she knew Dire Straits outside of Money for Nothing, but that she was such a fan of such a deep cut. For whatever reason, that always stuck out at me. And, you know, what happened next is for a different podcast, but it was a good night.
No, that, I mean, man, when you find somebody who can, like you said, have an appreciation for a deep cut like that at a young age too, that's,
She was younger than us. I mean, it was, you know, that was important.
Well, you know, we, yeah, no, that's something. I always wonder, and I meant to look this up. Bad job by me not looking it up, but Skate Away, did that have anything to do with inspiring Roller Girl in Boogie Nights?
You know, it's a good question. I've wondered that too. Now, Boogie Nights is set in, I want to say probably 76 or 77.
Right.
This came out in 80, but anything's possible. I mean, roller skating was a really big thing in the '70s and early 80s. So it's possible.
Right. It just always reminds me of that.
And even lyrically, it would almost suggest it, right? She's making movies on location.
There you go.
She don't know what it is.
Right. It's a whole different reading of that. Yeah.
That's true. What do you think? Perfect album?
As good as it is, I don't think so, just because to me it doesn't stick the landing. You know, I think it can definitely get away with like the 6th track, but I think ending it with Les Boys, while I didn't pick it for my nadir, I think it does keep it from being perfect.
Hmm.
I also would have loved to have another track or two. I mean, you know, it feels like it's over just when it's beginning.
One of the outtakes from the album, I think, got released on like a greatest hits or something, is a song called Twisting by the Pool, which is actually pretty good. And I sometimes wonder if they just threw that one other song on there,
might have made
a difference, making it even eight.
Yeah. I mean, listen, either, you know, that aside, it's, not to take anything away from it, it's a fantastic album. How about you? Would you say perfect album?
I would. Yes, I would say it's a perfect album. You know, for the longest time, I would have said no because of the aforementioned Les Boys.
Yeah.
But in listening to the album more often of late and coming to the realization that the album is, in my belief, like I said earlier, structured like a film that has a series of vignettes, I think Les Boys is just one of the stories that's to be told on the album. And it just happens to be not as good a story as the rest of them. I look at it like this. Yeah, think about Pulp Fiction, all right, which is also a cluster of vignettes of sorts. The Butch storyline, that's the storyline involving Bruce Willis, in my opinion, was always much weaker compared to the storylines that featured John Travolta's character and Samuel Jackson's character. But does that make the movie any less amazing? No, it's still fantastic. And that's kind of how I look at this. I think Les Boys is awkward. It's downright strange. It is weaker than the rest of the album, but I think it serves its purpose in being there to just tell a story, as does every single one of the seven tracks on this album. And I look at it like this too. Making movies has a running time of 37 minutes. 30 of those minutes, in my opinion, are complete perfection.
Yeah.
And to me, that makes it a perfect album.
I hear you. I think it would be, to me, the unfortunate thing is that comes at the end. You know, I think if Les Boys was kind of sandwiched in the middle somewhere, maybe you pass over it a little more easily, but for such a great album, it would be nice to really end it on a big booming note.
Would you take this album over Brothers in Arms?
That's tough. I know what I'm supposed to say. I'm supposed to say yes, because this is, you know, the more critically acclaimed one. Brothers in Arms is, you know, a little more glitzy, glossy.
Well, Brothers in Arms was the much bigger commercial success, though, so we can't deny it. It's accolades.
Yeah. Man, it's real close. I think Brothers in Arms, I think there's a few more songs on Brothers in Arms that, you know, a few more low points. It's probably not as consistently good. But I really like Brothers in Arms.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that.
No, it's all right.
Nothing wrong with me.
What would you go with making movies?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
And look, that's not the point of the podcast. It's not the point of this episode, is to compare and contrast the two. Brothers in Arms has some great, great moments, but I think that the top-notch moments on Making Movies are really a watershed moment in the career of Mark Knopfler and of this band. The last 2.5 minutes of Tunnel of Love that we referenced earlier, that is just absolute perfection.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic album.
So do yourselves a favor, folks. Carve out 37 minutes of time over the next week or so and listen to Making Movies by Dire Straits, an album that is celebrating its 40th birthday, on October 17th. How about that, right?
Amazing.
Chris, as always, thank you. And thank you all for listening to us, those folks in Lithuania and Saudi Arabia, New Zealand, Peru, Morocco, and beyond. And tune in next week.
Yes, and hit us up at Podcast Closely or on Instagram. What is it again, John? It's
listenclosely.podcast.
Yes, and please, if you have a second and you can rate or review or both for our podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. John, it's been a pleasure.
See you next week. Always a pleasure.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.